Welcome to episode 242. We'll talk to Clint Black in just a little bit. Always fun to talk to people you loved when you were a kid. He's got new music out too, but we definitely get into a lot of the 90s stuff. Before we turn the mics on here, Mike, you had asked me if I'd heard the new Dixie Chick song.
Yeah.
And I haven't, because I guess the song came out today, right?
Yeah.
I woke up today, and for the first time in 5 years, I want to play golf today. Eddie and Amy's husband, Ben, and I want to play it, so I haven't really done anything. I just, you know, we're going to go over music here, but I'm just not feeling a lot of music right now, oddly. For a music podcast, I don't know if it's because I'm really not listening to as much music because I'm not commuting ever. Or if nothing's really hitting me right now. And we'll go through some new stuff. Maybe some of this stuff will hit you. But I was more excited to talk to Clint Black about the 90s than I am anything new coming out today, you know? I think a lot of people are feeling that way right now. Once we get back to somewhat normal, I think some of our normal habits will kind of kick back in. But have you been listening to new music at all?
This week is probably like the first week I started listening to some new stuff.
What do you listen to that's new?
I've been listening to Machine Gun Kelly a lot, and he put out a new song today, and I was checking it out. And it's weird because I know him as a rapper, but a lot of the stuff he's putting out is a lot more alternative sounding.
Is he singing?
Yeah, and he's playing guitar a lot, so I like the sound.
Everybody being Post Malone now, basically?
Pretty much. He didn't have that sound before. Now it's like he's on alternative radio. It's weird.
Kind of feel like Post Malone created that space of like using, rapper, but you can also do rock if you know how to play guitar.
Yeah, using real instruments. That's all him.
All right. Well, let's start with some new music out this week, and I will start with the Dixie Chicks song because you had brought that up to me. The Dixie Chicks were supposed to put out Gaslighter, the whole album.
Mm-hmm.
It was the first record in 14 years, but it has been pushed back indefinitely because of Corona. But they did put out this new song, and it is called Juliana?
Juliana.
You said both.
Juliana.
Somehow you said Juliana and Juliana. Anna in the same word. Here is Juliana, Calm Down.
I guess this is the time to remind you sometimes what's going through your head is just a temporary situation and light will soon be shed. Oh, just put on your best shoes and strut the fuck around like you've got nothing to lose. Show off your best moves and do it with a smile so that no one knows it's put on.
It's got a cool vibe.
Yeah.
I can't really find the chorus because I'm hearing it from a random time. Is that the chorus?
Like that part towards like maybe 20 seconds into the chorus.
Put on. And Katie, calm down.
You know, it sounds like a slightly country Florence and the Machine.
Oh, yeah, it kind of does.
I was hearing it and I was going, all right, what am I hearing here? Play that from the beginning again, just with a clip.
I guess this is the time to remind you sometimes what's going through your head is just a temporary situation.
Do you hear that? Like the Florence Welch kind of. I mean, yeah. I'll probably like that. I can't tell from hearing this one clip of a song. But that sounds like my kind of vibe. They're oddly hard to get a hold of, meaning they didn't want to be interviewed or they don't want me to interview them. And I think I've been one of their biggest advocates, oddly, but I can't get any of them to talk to me, which is weird because usually that's not the case. It's the opposite. People are trying to get on because of, you know, the platform that we have. So, but the Dixie Chicks has been weird because I've been like pro Dixie Chick forever and they just have been like, oh, we're getting away from Bobby. We ain't talking to him. I don't know why. Let's go Here and Now from Kenny Chesney. This is record 19. Is that right?
Yeah.
Dang. Here's the title track, Here and Now.
Here and now, nowhere else in this world tonight. You and me ain't it good to be.
And here's a song called Everyone She Knows.
She's born with all the boys, and I met her too damn old. She's sick of summer love, but the winter's just too cold. She's a Maryland in blue jeans with a touch of.
I mean, it definitely sounds like Kenny. That's crazy, it's in 19 records. I mean, Kenny was out. You know, when he started, some of those guys that are just called 90s country were still around kicking, and they're considered 90s country, but Kenny started then as well and has managed to continue. Look up when his first record came out.
I think I looked it up earlier. It was like 91, I want to say.
Wow, was it?
I was looking through all his albums earlier just to make sure.
Like, Kenny and McGraw are two guys where if they had stopped after a few big records or had kind of petered out, they'd be considered legacy acts. But they have just continued to produce, continue to put out hits. Man, if it was 91, I'd be shocked.
Let's see, studio albums. Oh, 94.
Even then, as early, wow. Good for him. I like Kenny. I got to sit with Kenny on stage, and it was just him and I, and he played acoustic the whole time. And we would talk and do interviews and make jokes and stuff. But he's just a really good singer, you know? When you think of the big singers, you don't think of Kenny Chesney. You think of a guy, Kenny just puts out the beach hits. But just sitting there acoustic with a guitar was surprisingly good. The K is silent from Hot Country Nights. This is Dirk Bentley's 90s-influenced comedy band. This was always a bit difficult because the songs are pretty good. They're even good and funny. But it was always weird to talk to them on radio because it's such a visual thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I would feel like sometimes it wouldn't come across like I wanted it to on radio because unless you could see them, you really weren't getting the joke. Because it just sounds like Dirk Bentley making jokes. And so this was always a thing that we had to juggle on the radio with Dirk's as Doug Douglasson, because he would come on and be moderately funny, but what he was wearing was hilarious. But people can't see what he's wearing when they're listening live. So that was always a juggle for me. I would imagine they're kind of done with this project at this point, especially they were going to go on a little tour,
mm-hmm.
but that got cut, as did everybody else's. But they had songs that were good, that were, aside from the funniness of it, had good hooks. Here is Hot Country Nights with Travis Tritt, a song called Pick Her Up.
Pick her up in a pickup truck. Take her out to a honky-tonk. Turn an ice cold long lick up. Dance around to an old jukebox.
You know, what's funny is the three artists we've talked about so far, and then we're going to get to Clint Black in a second. Dixie Chicks, 90s, 2000s. Kenny Chesney started in 94, right? Is that what you said?
Yeah, 94.
And then Dirk Bentley's band is a 90s pop parody band. I mean, that 90s is it's the real retro in vogue thing right now. Either you came from the 90s and you're making a new sound, or you're new and you're making a 90s sound. As long as you got some feeling of the 90s, people are like, oh, I accept that. That's pretty cool. Do you feel that at all?
Why is that, though, the 90s?
Well, I think that's when country music went massively mainstream, so all the big stars are there.
You think it'll ever shift to a different decade, or is just something about the 90s?
I think that was the Garth Brooks, Brooks and Dunn. I mean, I think for a while it was probably the 60s.
Mm.
I don't know there was ever a 70s and 80s boom. Maybe a little, you know, but 90s, and I don't think the 2000s were great. Just generally speaking, I think it's, you know, the most songs. When you think of all those massive songs from the 90s, I mean, McGraw, Garth, Dixie Chicks, even, you know, Chesney, Joe Diffie, Clint Black. It was just a really good time for country music. A lot of money was going in to support it because they were seeing that it could make a lot of money. So I can't see the 2000s. Maybe, you know, you have like a Luke Combs tribute band later in life.
Maybe.
Which Luke has a new song out too. That's interesting though. I'm going to think about that. Why the 90s? A couple reasons. One, I think the age of all the people making decisions were 90s listeners.
Mm.
The adults now were big 90s kids. So the people that are making the decision as adults, the music that's getting made, the artists for a lot of them were 90s influenced. I think that's probably what it is. And then the stars. That's the biggest generation of country stars. Luke Combs has officially released 6 Feet Apart. We played the YouTube version a couple weeks ago, but this song is up to stream.
I miss my mom, I miss my dad, I miss the road, I miss my band, giving hugs and shaking hands. It's a mystery, I suppose.
You know, I saw the title of this, and I think I mentioned this on last week's podcast. I thought, how in the world is he going to do a song that's not cheesy about quarantine? Because I've heard 100 of them, and they're almost all cheesy.
Mm-hmm.
This is a pretty good one. I mean, everything he writes right now just turns into gold. He played the Opry, and I was hosting it last week, and it was great. He played this at the Opry last week. Kip Moore put out a new song called Crazy For You Tonight.
And I'm my mind, yeah.
Brett Young put out a new song called Lady. Here's Brett Young.
Just like your mama and love her like I do. You'll see close to perfect patience if you watch her every move. You can always run to daddy.
Let me see what else we got here. I got some other stuff. What's your favorite on the list here? I don't want to go through all these. What's your favorite on the list that we haven't played? Oh, I do see your Machine Gun Kelly song.
Yeah, Machine Gun Kelly.
Let me hear this one.
I don't do fake love, but I'll take some from you tonight.
It does sound like Fall Out Boy meets like an angry Blink-182.
It has that
thing.
2000 yeah. Punk rock feel.
Yeah, it does. That's straight alternative stuff. That's not. That's
yeah.
crazy.
Yeah.
I would never guess that was Machine Gun Kelly. Huh. I mean, that sounds like your style, though.
Yeah, very much so.
It sounds like he showed up late for Warped Tour about 5 years.
Yeah.
Like, his style is a little beyond that, but he could have fit in. Marshmello and Halsey. I saw them laying on the ground together on Instagram. I guess like a promo for this song. This is called Be Kind. Let's see if there's anything else I want to... I'll just mention some of this. Haim? I thought it was Haim. But when I got no reaction back to Haim...
Haim?
The Three Sisters, they have a... I Know Alone. Don't need to play that. Gabby Barrett has a song featuring Shane and Shane.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what Shane and Shane is. I thought it was like a Shane and Shane company.
No.
Like a jewelry company. Do you ever see that commercial?
Oh, yeah. It's a Christian duo.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
I imagine both are named Shane?
Shane and Shane.
All right. Hardy has a new song called Boots. Let me hear a little bit of Mitchell Tenpenny's cover of Someone You Loved by Lewis Capaldi.
Now the day bleeds into nightfall, hanging on here to
get. Okay, start this again. Let's start it over. And I like Mitchell. Know Mitchell a little bit. Is he using auto-tune on this?
Yeah, you can hear it.
I thought so, too. It's like, man, if you're going to chase one of these really big vocal songs.
And he's a good singer.
Let me hear this again.
Now the day bleeds.
Yeah, you can hear it kind of teeping.
It goes,
Odd choice of a song to pick if you have to use auto-tune.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, everybody has pitch shifted a little bit. I've only known a couple of artists that go in and go, don't touch it, my vocal. That's Carrie's one of them. Maybe they'll put some effect on it, but they don't pitch shift her vocal.
It's very noticeable.
Wow. I mean, I would, Raging Idiot stuff, I would just pitch shift all of it. So, like, yeah, we're doing this. Just everybody knows. Like, Emoji Love Song, I think a lot of that we just were like, instead of having to fix little parts, let's just pitch shift the whole thing so people know it's very obviously. Mm-hmm. Not the live version, but the studio version. By the way, yes, I'm comparing Emoji Love Song by the Raging Idiots to... let's see, and Hardy has a new song called Boots. The alt-country band American Aquarium. Now, I don't know who they are, but are they good?
I kind of like the sound, yeah.
I wouldn't have thought you'd have put this up if you didn't think it was cool.
Yeah, I heard it, and I was like, I could probably see myself listening to this.
All right, let me hear, hold on. The alt-country band American Aquarium. All right, I'm into it. They have a new album out called Lamentations. Lamentations?
I think so.
Okay. Here's a song called The Luckier You Get. Let me see if I dig it.
The harder you work.
It sounds a little bit like Tom Petty and the Wallflowers.
Mm-hmm.
The Wallflowers meets the Wallflowers. Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers meets the Wallflowers, okay. What I'm trying to say. Tom Petty also has an album called Wildflower. I think. I got all these in my head, but I would say it's like the Wallflowers meets Tom Petty. That's cool. All right, let me see here. Yeah. Tom Petty's album, Wildflowers, is one of my favorite records. Just want to make sure I said that right. Were you ever a Tom Petty fan?
Not really.
The song, You Belong Among the Wildflowers. You know that one?
I don't think so. Oh,
that's a good one. And then, You Don't Know How It Feels. No, You Don't Know How It Feels to Be Me. You know that one?
I know that one.
Yeah, that's a good one. Let me see what else is on. You wreck me, baby. Doom, doom. You wreck me into. You know that one?
Let's see.
God, this song is so mean.
This song? No, that's Chariots Fire.
That's Chariots. Yeah, that is not a Tom Petty song.
This song.
You wreck me. Yeah, that's a jam. You know this one?
I don't know this one.
God. This reminds me, I'm not even interested in new music. I would sit here on this record for a long time. That's what we should do. We should break down our favorite albums and all the songs on it. Because I'm looking at this like, no, track five, It's Good to Be King. It's good to be king if just for a day. See if you know this one.
Let's see. Don't think so.
When your bulldog barks and your canary sings. No?
Mm-mm.
Man, this is a jam album. Top 20 album for me here, for sure.
It's good to be king just for a while. To be there in velvet.
Yeah, to give them a smile. Nothing?
Nothing.
Man, you're missing out. Never come down. All right. Well, that's it. We want to update you on new music. And also, we're going to play this Clint Black interview. What kind of stumbly today? I was out in the sun today for 4 hours playing golf. And I think the sun is not cooperating with my body at this point because it's been months since I've seen it.
Too much vitamin D for one day?
So. I think I'm overdosing on vitamin D. Okay, here, we'll take a little break. Come back with Clint Black. Enjoy. Hey, Clint, it's Bobby. How's it going?
Hey, Bobby. Well, it's going nowhere fast.
Yeah, that I get. I saw today it was like day 50 with no sports, day 4. I mean, it does feel like a big old blur, doesn't it?
Yeah, it starts to just not matter what day of the week it is.
Well, before we get rolling here, we're already rolling, but before we get like moving through, I just want to tell you, I think I've mentioned this to you before, but I'm just a massive fan of yours, so it's really exciting for me to get to talk to you.
Well, thanks. You know, I'm a fan of yours, but I really wasn't a massive fan until I saw you dance.
Well, you probably, yeah, that isn't a good look for me with you, so we'll move away from that.
Oh, my God. No, yeah. I was asked to do that show a couple of times, and it's just absolutely no way on earth. You're a brave man. Well, you know, obviously you have the chops, too. I would have. I only dance the silly dance to make my family laugh.
Well, I feel like that's what I should do. Just only the silly dance. Well, you know, I'm excited to see that you're putting out a new record coming out. Hey, tell me about Out of Sane, because I was thinking about this. Is that the opposite of insane? Out of Sane.
You know, it's actually there are multiple interpretations of that, and it really comes from a little, you know, play online from one of the songs. Song title is What I Knew Then. And the line is a little in and out of sane. So I didn't like any of the song titles. I usually will name an album after one of the song titles that sums it up. But I didn't like any of them for that. The same with my last album On Purpose. So I just scoured the lyrics for something that made sense. And when I thought of that, when I thought, this is, you know, seriously speaking, that, you know, the writing of songs, the creating of music is really, you know, born out of sanity. And then you go through the recording process, and by the time it's down to all the music's recorded and now I'm trying to mix it and make sure scientifically everything has its place and it's going to sound good on any system it's played on, it just becomes a science. And it's really kind of borders on insanity at that point. It's no longer this art form. It's a science. And it's just 5 hours of sleep a night and working on that, you know, for 18 hours a day, and by the time I get to the end of making an album, there's a reason I only do one about every 5 years now. I'm getting no sleep. I want it to be over. And so I start out sane and end up insane, and I thought that really sums it up. When I always wanted to use that photo for the cover, with that American flag guitar of mine. And I thought that also brings in another interpretation, because it seems our country, you know, is a little in and out of same. And just depending on what cycle we're in. So I thought this is a title that anybody can see any way they want for their own uses. But for me, it spoke to the album. It spoke to the process, which, you know, it's not ironwork, which I've done. You know?
Right.
But it's it gets to be grueling at one point. You just need to call it finished, but not until it's right.
Well, the full album is set for a June 19th release. And you know, we're 6 or so weeks out from that. Do you feel like any of this that's happening now is going to affect that release date, or are you determined that that's the date the project's coming out?
Oh, we're firm. We're firm on it. We've got the video. The second and third Instant Grat tracks are lined up and ready to go. It's all in the system, and I've just gotten my little, I'm going to call it a broadcast studio. It's my recording studio, but I've finally gotten all the elements. You know, it's hard. It's a lot of stuff like this is back ordered. You know, I needed a converter to go from my, you know, my 4K camera into the computer to use it, you know, for live streaming. And also wanted to tie that in with Pro Tools. So it's been this step-by-step process of getting to the point where I can start live streaming and promoting the album from my studio.
I've been watching this, The Last Dance, which is the Bulls documentary. I think they've put out 4 episodes now. And, you know, it's about, you know, Michael Jordan's, his final season with the Bulls. And they do this really cool thing where they go back in time, current, that kind of thing. And if you'll... you know, kind of indulge me a little bit. I'd like to do that now, where I want to talk about new stuff and then kind of do a flashback and then come back and forth with a new project. Will you indulge me in this type of...
Absolutely,
all right,
yeah.
Perfect. We'll see how it goes. I like you, had a lot of jobs before I kind of got into what I'm doing now, where I worked at a marina and did bait work. As well. Were you a bait cutter? What was that job about?
That was... One of the guys at my management company, when he was taking down stuff about me, you know, what I'd done, he was basically putting together a simple bio, and he laughed and said, "I'm going to put, because I was an iron worker. I worked in security as a consultant salesman and sold security services, and I actually didn't. I starved, but." You know, I had, you know, I was a newspaper solicitor, had a paper route as a kid, you know, and he laughed and said, "I'm going to put down bait cutter and fishing guide." And I laughed, and then suddenly it's in a newspaper and it went everywhere. And so it was not true, and I thought he was kidding, but, you know, they had managed rock and roll acts, and I was their first country act, and I think maybe, you know, they, it's like Kenny Loggins told me once, he said, "When I'm not doing anything interesting," I'm paraphrasing, he said, "I'll make stuff up and say I'm somewhere I'm not." And just after he told me that, I was doing an interview over the phone, and interviewer asked me, "So where are you calling from?" I said, "I'm in Barbados." "Really? What are you doing in Barbados?" And I said, "I'm not really in Barbados." I couldn't even do it.
That's funny. So you never were a bait cutter, but now that's been part of your bio legacy all these years.
Yep. People still want me to tell them where the fish are.
That's funny, because I literally was a bait cutter, and I don't put that in my bio anymore. I was a cricket grabber, because I would shovel crickets into tubes for people. I would cut bait. I would catch shad and give them out. I was a bit of a small-time fishing guide. And, man, maybe I should put that in my bio. People ask me about that, because I was really interested to hear that story.
You know, you want that word to get around, so when this job falls apart on you, you know, you'll have somewhere to go. People, the demand will be there.
I wonder, you know, as you have this new record, we're weeks away from it coming out, and, You know, you are a guitar player. Are you playing lead on the record?
I play most of the electric guitar stuff. I do some slide dobro and electric slide. Yeah.
Do you find that
I started that with the Nothing But the Taillights album when Stroud heard my demos and he said, "You should play guitar on this." Well, Hayden Nicholas, my lead guitar player, really got me started when we were writing songs one day, and he said, "You know, with your finger picking style, you could play licks like this Ray Flack stuff." And I laughed and laughed, and he said, "No, really." And he taught me some things to practice, and I went home and got a little, you know, I had a sequencer, call it a metronome, and I started practicing slowly and sped it up until I was convinced I can play stuff like this. And so I played most of the everything but three songs on Nothing But the Taillights, and then I did Electrified, which was all acoustic, and there wasn't much to do there. And then I started doing it again, and on the On Purpose album, I really dug into it and made myself take on a lot of that work. Whereas, you know, I might reach out to Hayden to hurry it along, or Steve Warner or Brent Mason, you know, because they can do it in a flash. And I decided I'm going to take the time. It takes me longer. But if I can make myself happy as the producer artist, then I'm going to do it. And so it's really satisfying. And it's been a really, it's been a real, you know, I like, you'd like to think you're going to get better with age, right? And the fact that I can play guitar solos on Tuckered Out now, which is our barn burner, really convinced me that there's still room for growth, but I have to work really hard for it.
I'm going to run some numbers by you here. The number is 1991. You were chosen by People magazine as one of the 50 most beautiful people in the entire world. How vivid is that memory when you got that call?
You know what? I just flashed on all the makeup and wardrobe it took to earn that title. you know, it's funny. I can't even remember, you know, I can't even remember that. So much was happening to me, coming at me, happening for me. I remember now that you say it, that that I was given that, but no, I can't remember that feeling. You know, I imagine I'm on the bus with the band and they're all mocking me. That's probably what we were doing.
Whenever something like that that's outside of the country genre happens, because that's very mainstream, do you start to hear from other people that you thought you would never hear from, that to go, "Hey, I saw you in People magazine. I also like what you're doing. I just haven't reached out yet."
No, not really in that way. I would meet people outside my genre. I assume you're talking about other artists.
Yeah, artists, actors, anyone that was like, "Hey, I saw comedians. You in People magazine." Yeah.
Yeah, but it was never clear to me that one thing was happening because of the other. I would meet people like Gary Shandling when he was hosting the Grammys, and he said, "Hey, you should do my show. You should come on and let's, you know, goof around." And so I did his show and ended up going and playing basketball over at his house every Sunday for, you know, quite a while, and meeting a lot of people over there. I think that's how Kevin Nealon and I became friends. I met Eric Idle because Lisa worked with a fitness trainer who trained Eric's wife, and so I said, "Hey, would you give this phone number to Tanya and see if I'm going to record a Monty Python song and see if he would be willing to do something on it." And so that led to working with him and becoming friends with him, and then meeting people through him, other comedians and actors, and it just never, I never really knew, okay, well, this is because of my music, or it's just because I reached out or I met someone through someone else.
You have 22 number one singles. What's the, when you play the first lick of what song do people react the loudest to?
Well, that Killing Time lick on the intro is pretty definitive. Better Man is really recognizable, and those were, you know, those were huge for me, like The Rain. Of course, I don't do the intro lick in concert from Like The Rain. I wrote another little acoustic guitar piece that I do on the front end of that, and then when I start singing it, they know. And Nothing But The Tail Lights, that lick's really recognizable.
With some of these songs that you play and you have played for, you know, this at this point for 30 years, do you ever go, man, I want to switch up this arrangement because I'm kind of bored with playing the same song over and over and over again. Like, you want to play it for the fans, but you want to switch it up a little bit. Has that happened at all?
Yeah, I'm really careful about that. I keep in mind that they have some ownership in it and an attachment. And so, you know, I'm a music fan. When I see someone in concert, I've seen that happen and not liked it. I've also seen it and liked it. I've done that on records where I did a version of Put Yourself in My Shoes, a real slow blues version with a 12-piece horn section instead of harmonica. And I did that for the Second Greatest Hits, Extra Tracks. And I did a version of No Time to Kill with Bruce Hornsby that was a real funky version. And I played around with A Bad Goodbye, and I felt some liberties with that because I wasn't doing it with Wynonna, so the song wasn't going to be what it was anyway. I messed around with a different arrangement. But I'm careful. I try to be careful about it.
The new song that I was listening to before I called you is America, Still in Love with You. I'm going to play a little bit of that real quick, and I'm going to ask you a couple thoughts about it. Here's a clip of America, Still in Love with You.
I'm still in love with you, in spite of all our ups and downs. We've gone our separate ways, but we've come back around.
So, even when you wrote that with Steve Warner, eh?
Yep.
So tell me about that day when you guys go into the room to do this.
Well, Steve had been coming over. We'd been doing stuff together, just hanging out. He would come by for one reason or another. And every time I'd say, you didn't bring your new Steve Warner Gretsch? I ordered one, and it was taking a while to get it. And I hadn't seen his. And, oh, I forgot. And so one day I said, well, you just have to come over with the intent of bringing that guitar. So you won't forget it. So he came over one day just to show me that, and we were playing around with it. And after we'd played around for a while, I said, oh, I have this new song idea. And I told it to him, and it was kind of the basics of the chorus. Sounds like a love song, you know, to a woman, and you get to the end of the chorus, and America is the lady. And he just reacted perfectly, just couldn't, I didn't see that coming. And yeah, we got to write that. And I just launched into it. I said, what could we do musically? And we started playing around, and we just dove right in, literally standing around the kitchen, the den off the kitchen. And once I saw that we had a structure and a direction on the verses, I started texting musicians to see who was available, and within about 4 days we were all in the studio recording it. And I knew I had to hurry in order to make the deadline for this album, and I wanted it to be on the album, my love of the song and the message, but also it just went so well with the cover, and it just has to be on there. And I literally made it about the same day as my deadline, got the master delivered.
Well, the video's out too now, so people can check out not only the song, but America, Still in Love with You. The music video is out. So, man, still making the videos. Huh? Are they harder to make now or easier?
they're harder to make in quarantine. I was, again, just ordering pieces, and they would come, and it was the wrong piece. You know, I would order a lens I thought I needed, and turned out, you know, it just wasn't gonna work for the framing. And you know, back in the day, you know, making them for RCA, of course, I had these, you know, great budgets, about $85,000. And I worked with a video producer, Brent Hedgecock, who really enabled me to be a director when I wasn't really a director. But I got to write the treatments. I would write out a treatment for the video, and he would budget it out, and he would come back and he'd say, that's about a $300,000 video. You've got to cut more than $200,000 worth of ideas out of this video. And so that would happen every time. And we'd finally get it down to where it fit the budget, and we would go shoot it. And he was so much fun to work with, such a creative guy, that when he no longer produced videos, I really lost my enthusiasm for it for a while. And I really just kind of stopped. And then, you know, when I started putting out these records on purpose, and this one, you know, the management company, the first video I did in a while was This Old House, which is an homage to the Grand Ole Opry. And the Opry gave me access to all their archival footage. And so I went through everything, and I put together a really nice piece that that spoke to the Opry and that old house and that family of, you know, 100 years. And I sent a copy to the management company, and you know, they came back and said, this is great. This is really great. I love it. And they said, but we really think you should be in it. I wasn't in it. And I was disappointed, and just, you know, a big sigh. I said, no, really, I don't need to be in it. And we went back and forth that way for a while. And they finally convinced me that I needed to be in it. And part of it was, I really didn't feel like I needed to be in it. This was going to move people just by watching all of these great, you know, Opry moments. And then the other part was, I didn't know how I was going to do it. How was I going to fit into this? And so when I agreed I was going to put myself in the video, I started thinking, and at one moment I had the idea that I could be the backstage guide. And once that happened, the ideas started coming, and the Harry Potter, you know, picture frames come to life idea hit me, and I called my editor, said, okay, we have to do this. How easy is it going to be? You know, what do we have to do on the front end? So once that happened, then the creative juices were flowing, and I managed to get it done.
You know, I was looking back, and you can tell me if I'm wrong here. I'm going from memory. But I look back because I had, like everybody else, I had the Killin' Time tape. And so from the record Killin' Time. But I don't think that was Better Man, my recollection, was Better Man a single before Killin' Time was?
Yeah, actually, you know, the first single was set to be Straight from the Factory. And I was worried about it in cities. I knew it would go over in Texas and Oklahoma, and I was just kind of worried about it. And we got to KZLA in Los Angeles, and Bob Guerra was the program director, and we're sitting in his office, and playing that song, and he stops the tape, and he says, well, he said, I could add that if you get it into the top 20. So I knew what that meant. I know a lot about the business yet, but I also didn't know if it would be okay for me to pull this tape I had in my pocket out and play him something from it. Carson Schreiber was the promotion guy there, and I kind of looked over at him and decided I'm just going to do it. And I pulled out the tape and I said, Bob, pop this in and play that first song. And it was Better Man. And that's what I was thinking, you know, would be a better first single. But I let him play it. And at the end of the first chorus, he stopped the tape and said, I'll add that out of the box. So we got out of there and called the head of RCA and said, you know, here's what just happened. And the decision was made on the spot to switch to A Better Man.
And how fast did that song make you feel like you were firmly in the country music community?
It took a while. You know, I was still traveling around in a 12-seater van pulling a U-Haul trailer 400-500 miles a day, a night. And so it was about a 17-week climb to number one. So we started promoting it in, I think, late February, and it peaked in mid-June. I think that's 17 weeks. Anyway, it really seemed to be going fast to me, but that was not a quick climb back then. But it was rare for a debut single to go to number one, and so I'm hearing all these things and, you know, getting perspective. By the time that hit, I think I was, by the time it really you know, started to peak, I think I was getting some slots opening for the Judds and acts like that. So it started to feel more like, this is going to work. I'm going to make it.
When you guys decided to put out Killing Time second, and the song, again, looking back at as my history, I feel like Killing Time was even bigger than A Better Man.
Well, it had a step up on Better Man. And I think it was more of a honky-tonk song. And, you know, but again, I'm stepping off a debut number one, releasing that. So that song getting added, I think the promotion team had a little easier time pushing that one out. So it had a little bit of an advantage. But it's also, you know, it's a different feel and flavor and texture. Better Man was kind of Haggard-esque, and Killing Time wasn't. I don't know what I'd call it, but for my sensibilities, it really felt like you're going to get different things from me. It was important to me that I had diversity in my body of work, and I felt like that song really spoke to that.
What was it like plotting a tour back in the late 80s, early 90s? Would you have to use a phone book to call places? Like, on the bus, would you have a phone book to pull over and call places?
Well, I had nothing to do with that part of it. I had to, I just did interviews and showed up at radio stations and you know, Targets, etc. But yeah, back then, you know, we'd have to get to a hotel room, get in there and get on the phone. You know, it was a while before, you know, I got that 15-pound cellular phone.
Did you ever do one? You talk about Targets and Walmart. Did you ever go to one of these signings and it got to the point where it was so crazy because you had so many hits in a row?
It was crazy. It was, you know, I've said recently, you know, that back then I was pretty level-headed. I feel like I never got the big head, and that I treated everyone well. But I don't know, because it was so crazy, and I wasn't nearly as comfortable with it as I am now. It took me a long time to get used to being famous and the center of attention and, you know, being in the middle of chaos. It was really hard to adapt to. So I felt like I went from one chaotic moment to another. And there were times where, you know, we're doing 9 shows in a row, 1 day off, 8 shows in a row, 1 day off. I mean, they had me really going, and I was reaching the point of really just the point of breaking. And told my manager, I said, I'm not going to last like this. And, you know, we have to have some spacing in there. So, you know, we'd end up getting 2 days off. But I'd spend that doing interviews and stuff, you know. So it was really taking a toll on my vocal cords. And I tried to tell him, you know, listen to my melodies and listen to my songs. You know, I'm not Joe Cocker. I can't sing these things with a raspy voice, and I can't hit those high notes if I'm worn out.
You know, you were talking about Dancing with the Stars earlier. I didn't know that you were on the second season of The Apprentice back in the day. What was that like, 2004, doing The Apprentice?
It was really, I didn't know what I was getting into. I saw a clip or two. And, you know, to me, it was going to be going on. Some people were going to be jerks, you know, but we're going to go on and do these tasks. And I like those kinds of challenges. So I agreed to do it. And it was 18 and a half hours a day, every day but Sunday, for 5 and a half weeks.
Wow.
And some of the people were really hard to be around. Others were great to be around. And so I quickly realized that I don't have a strong enough desire to win this thing to compromise who I am. And I would have had to do that. I felt like, you know, calling up people I know and asking them for money, I didn't like. I didn't feel like it was great for the charity. I didn't win a lot of money for my charity. You know, I made more for my charity in 2 days after that than I did in 5 and a half weeks. And so I changed. I decided that my goal was going to be to keep my behavior in check and to maintain my standard of character and not let anyone draw me into bad behavior. That was my goal. That became, all right, I'm going to do my best with the tasks. I'm going to really limit, you know, calling up people and asking them for money. And I'm just going to try to get through this without letting someone bring out the worst in me. And I ended up, you know, I was 5th place. I was there right through the end. And, you know, proud of the way I handled it. But it was disgusting. You know, there was some behavior in that was just really hard to watch.
Dang. Well, on a lighter note, we're going to do one old and one new. And I want to run a few things, a few song titles that I love by you, and just a quick sentence or two about, you know, what that song at that time kind of reminds you of. We'll start with When My Ship Comes In.
God, the first thing I thought of was shooting the video for that, and, you know, the T-shirt on the sailboat, and it was 40 degrees. And they had a hurricane fan on me, so it's kind of apropos, since the song is about, you know, being in Colorado and waiting for your ship to come in. The whole reason that song came about was because of a Skip Ewing song called "The Coast of Colorado," and Hayden and I said, you know, let's jump off from there. And the other part of it was I'm a big Jimmy Buffett fan, and I wanted, you know, Gulf of Mexico came out of that, you know, love for his music, and and the style, the feeling of a ship came out of that too.
How about a good run of bad luck?
Hayden and I were in a hotel in Toronto. It was crazy snow blizzard. We had a little time, so we decided to try to write a couple of songs. We wrote Tuckered Out and Good Run of Bad Luck. And Good Run of Bad Luck, we knew what we wanted to say, but we wanted to make sure we had some good lingo, and I played Caesar's Palace a lot, so I thought, you know, they'll know me there if I call, and I called and got them to put me through to one of the pit bosses down, at the blackjack tables. And I got him on the phone, and so I started, you know, just trying to get slang out of him. And, you know, I'd say, like, you know, what do you guys call the high rollers? And he said, high rollers. And okay, got that one. And I'd ask him another question, and it would be kind of the same thing. So it got us pretty much nothing. But we started writing down all of the gambling stuff we could think of and just launched into writing.
One more from back in the day, Like the Rain.
Sitting in, I had had a house, my first house here in Nashville was way up north of town, and I needed to get into town because it was just too much driving. So I found some condo. I was in a high-rise condo in Nashville, and Lisa and I are sitting, looking out the window at Highway 70, and it was just pouring rain, and she loved it. And I really have had enough of rain in Houston. So I started playing, thinking, you know, what's rain music sound like? And I started playing that chord progression of the verse and came up with the first verse. I said, okay, that's enough. I'll get with Hayden next chance we get, and we'll write that.
I want to ask you about the new record, and we'll end with this. By the way, if you're listening right now, Clint's Web Store, brand new album, Focus Merchandise, that pre-sale autographed copies of the album, pre-sale CDs, vinyl. Go to clintblack.com/store. And I guess about the new record, I wonder, you know, just as someone who creates myself, like, you don't have to produce the whole thing. You don't have to play guitar. You don't have to do all of the intricate things that you're doing. Why do you keep doing it?
To save money. I from the first demos Hayden and I made, where you know, he showed me how he used an 8-track tape recorder to get as many tracks on there as possible, I became interested in that. When about 1996 or 7, I lucked into meeting the guys with DigiDesign, who created Pro Tools, and they set me up in our place in L.A. down in the basement with the Pro Tools gear, and babysat me through. I beta tested for them. I'd find problems, they'd come fix them, and so I was using Pro Tools and learning more and more about engineering. So when we got this new place in Nashville, I built a studio and really started becoming more and more a student of engineering. So I can sit and work by myself and do a lot of it, and I enjoy it. It's a challenge, but it's a creative outlet. And the result is it's just more of me going into my music, as much of an expression of myself as I can make. You know, I feel it'll be a better end result, or at least it'll be more me. As much of my taste in music, my sentiments, my, what I would like to hear. The songs, when I'm writing them, you know, they're talking to me already, telling me what they want. And then when I cut the basic track with a band, they're really talking then. And so it's more satisfying to give the song what it wants or needs myself than to hire someone to do it.
Well, I really appreciate the time. Good luck with the new record. It will be your 23rd album. Wow. Set for release June 19th, and Clint promises it will be out June 19th. So we're not moving it. It's going to be out June 19th. Dang it. So
that's it.
Clint, it is...
hey, man, it's great talking to you. This was interesting.
I never know what that means. When someone says this is interesting, you're like, interesting good or interesting bad or what?
Well, I'm saying interesting good. You know, I knew I could give you the long answers and ramble around to find the point I was making because it's a podcast. But you're also asking different questions that make me think more and go in depth to things. And, you know, I mean, I remember joking in the old days about, you know, some questions are, how did you and Mark O'Connor do that harmonica fiddle swap and Live and Learn? And how did that come together? And then there were the other questions, which were, why the hat?
Is that what you wanted? Clint, why the hat? Yeah.
Why the hat? Well, I finally came up with the answer to that question. Why do you wear a black hat? And it hit me. I know now. It's because it makes my head look thinner.
I need to wear a black hat. I've had a big head my whole life. When I was a kid, when I was a young kid, my mom would have to cut slits into the sides of my T-shirts to get my head to go through because it was abnormally large.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
I just had to make room for all those brains.
Yeah, I guess. One of my best friends, and because we're going to play some of this on my radio show, too, because I'm such a big fan, and I'm going to, you know, do radio and podcasts. This is going to be used everywhere, and even the countdown. So, but one of my dearest friends is named Eddie, and he was just recently asked on the national show if he could quarantine with one artist, who would it be? And he picked you, Clint Black. And
I saw that. I saw your tweet.
Yeah,
I saw that.
I was just curious what it's like.
Saying, you know, Clint and I have nothing in common, and I'm thinking, yeah, we do. And then I went, no, wait a minute. I wasn't even my first concert. We have nothing in common.
What do you do during quarantine? Like, what are you doing? What are you watching? Like, what can I give to him to show him that you guys probably do have some stuff in common?
Well, I've watched everything on Netflix. We watched Ozark.
Oh, man. Me too.
Every movie. You know, love. You know, I've watched the documentaries that Ray Romano made on building a stand-up act, and that Jerry Seinfeld did on where he took you all the way back to his first joke at the place he told it and went through all of his old material. And then his new documentary on building his new material. So I love to follow that stuff. I'm betting he's an Andy Griffith fan. Of course we all are. But Bosch on Amazon Prime is the best detective show ever. If you want to watch a show where the guy's not, you know, swinging off the side of a train, throwing grenades inside to kill the bad guys. You know, a real detective show, Bosch.
I'm going to pass all that to Eddie and tell him this is what you two would be doing, watching Bosch and Ray Romano write for his first joke.
That's it.
All right. Clint.
Then we were made for each other for quarantine.
All right. Hey, I'll let you get back to your life, but I'm a massive fan. Thank you for your time, and good luck with the record, and man, just keep being awesome.
Hey, thanks. You too. Big fan of yours, and I really enjoyed this. Thanks.
Thanks, Clint. Hopefully I'll talk to you soon.
And let's get out there and work again soon.
All right. Hopefully I'll see you soon.
Hope so.
All right, bye-bye.
Thanks, bye.